Abelard expected his appearance to draw little attention. He'd not forewarned his half-brother, and knew that the Baron would be upset when he found out. But Abelard continued into the enormous hall, proud and confident, and more nervous than he had ever been in his life. Vladimir would simply have to accept this. The Baron had other problems and obligations. His health had failed greatly over the years, and he'd put on such an enormous amount of weight that he now walked with the aid of suspensors. How the Baron kept going despite all that, Abelard didn't know. He understood little of the engines that drove his half-brother. Abelard quietly took a seat in the gallery and called up the agenda to see that the meetings had already fallen an hour behind the time slots, which was to be expected, he supposed. So he waited, straight-backed on the plastone bench, listening to dull business resolutions and minor adjustments to laws that he didn't pretend to care about or even understand. Despite the light shining through the stained glass windows and the heaters mounted under the cold stone, this enormous hall had a sterile feel to it. He just wanted to go home. When they finally called his name, Abelard emerged from his distraction and marched toward the speaker's podium. His knees were shaking, but he tried not to show it. On their high bench, the council members sat in formal gray robes. Glancing over his shoulder, Abelard saw empty seats in the section where formal Harkonnen representatives should have been. No one had bothered to attend this minor daily meeting. Not even Kallo Wills, the long-standing ambassador from Gedi Prime. No one had thought to inform Wills that the day's business would involve House Harkonnen. Perfect. He faltered as he remembered the last time he'd intended to address a group of people. His citizens rebuilding by Frost Eyrie, and the horrors that had befallen them before he could speak his piece. Now, Abelard drew a deep breath and prepared to address the chairman, a lean man with long braided hair and hooded eyes. He could not remember which house the chairman belonged to. Before Abelard could speak, however, the Master of Arms rattled off his name and titles in a long and droning sequence. Abelard hadn't known so many words could follow his name, since he was a relatively unimportant person in the Falfrelica system. But it did sound impressive. None of the sleepy members of the council appeared the least bit interested, however. They passed papers among themselves. "Your honors," he began. "Sirs, I have come to make a formal request. I have filed the appropriate paperwork to reclaim the title that is due me as Sub-District Governor of Rabban Lankavile. I have effectively served in this capacity for years, but I never submitted the proper documents." When he began to lay forth his reasoning and his justification in a voice rising with passion, the council chairman raised a hand. "You have followed the formal procedures required for a hearing, and the necessary notices have been dispatched." He shuffled through the documents in front of him. "I see the Emperor has received his notice as well." "That is correct," Abelard said, knowing that the message intended for his own half-brother had been sent by a slow, circuitous highliner route. A necessary sleight of hand. The chairman held up a single sheet of parchment. "According to this, you were removed from your position on Arrakis by the Baron Harkonnen." "Without my objection, Your Honor. And my half-brother has filed no objection to my petition today." This was true enough. The message was still en route. "Duly noted, Abelard Harkonnen." The chairman looked down. "Nor, I see, does the Emperor object." Abelard's pulse accelerated as he watched the chairman study the papers, the legal notices. "Have I forgotten something?" Finally, the chairman lifted his gaze. "Everything is in order. Approved." I have a second request," Abelard announced, somewhat unsettled that things had gone so rapidly and smoothly. "I wish to formally renounce my Harkonnen name." This caused a brief titter among the attendees. He summoned the words he had rehearsed so many times with Emmy and imagined her there beside him. "I cannot condone the actions of my family members," he said, without naming them. "I have a new son, Fade Rautha, and I wish him to be raised untainted, without the black mark of a Harkonnen name." The council chairman leaned forward, as if really seeing Abelard for the first time. "Do you fully understand what you're doing, sir?" "Oh, absolutely," he said, surprised at the strength in his voice. His heart swelled with pride at what he had just said. "I grew up on Giri Prime. I am the second surviving son of my father, Dmitri Harkonnen. My half-brother, the Baron, rules all Harkonnen holdings and does as he chooses. I ask only to keep Lankavile, the place I call my home." His voice softened, as if he thought a compassionate argument might move the board men listening to his speech. "I want no part of galactic politics or ruling worlds. I served my years on Arrakis and found that I didn't like it. I have no use for riches, power, or fame. Let such things remain in the keeping of those who desire them." His voice choked in his throat. "I want no more blood on my hands, and none for my new son." The chairman rose solemnly and stood tall in his gray robes. "You renounce all affiliation with House Harkonnen forever, including the rights and privileges pertaining thereto?" Abelard nodded vigorously, ignoring the muttering voices around the chamber. "Absolutely, and without equivocation. These people would have a great deal to talk about for days to come, but it mattered nothing to him. By then he would be on his way back home to Emmy and their baby. He wanted nothing, only a normal, quiet life and personal happiness. The rest of the Landsrad could continue without him. Henceforth I will take my wife's honored name of Rabban." The council chairman rapped his sonic gavel, which echoed with a boom of finality through the hall. "So noted. The council approves your request. Notification will be sent immediately to Giri Prime and to the Emperor." While Abelard stood stunned by his good fortune, the sergeant-at-arms called the next representative, and he found himself ushered out of the way. Rapidly leaving the building, he put the hall of oratory behind him. Outside, sunshine splashed his face again, and he heard the tinkle of fountains and the music of chime kites. His step had a new lightness, and he grinned foolishly. Others might have trembled at the momentous decision he had just made, but Abelard Rabban felt no fear. He'd achieved everything he'd hoped to accomplish, and Emmy would be so pleased. He raced to pack up the few possessions he'd brought with him and headed for the spaceport, anxious to return to quiet, isolated Lankavile, where he could begin a new and better life. There is no such thing as a law of nature. There is only a series of laws relating to man's practical experience with nature. These are laws of man's activities. They change as man's activities change. Pardot Kynes, an Arrakis primer. Even after 6 months on Seleucia Secundus, Leet Kynes still marveled at the wild and restless landscape, the ancient ruins and the deep ecological wounds. As his father had said, it was fascinating. Meanwhile, in his underground hideout, Dominic Vernius studied records and pored over stolen reports of Choam activities. He and Gurney Halleck scrutinized Spacing Guild manifests to determine how best to sabotage business dealings in ways that would cause the most harm to the Emperor. His occasional contacts and spies who gave him scant details of the Ixion situation, had vanished. He had once received occasional intelligence from his lost ancestral home, but finally, even that source had dried up. Dominic's reddened eyes and frown-creased face showed how little sleep he had been getting. For himself, Leet finally saw beyond the intrigues of the desert people and inter-clan rivalries for control of Spice Sands. He observed the politics between great and minor houses, shipping magnates, and powerful families. The Imperium was far more vast than he had imagined. He also began to grasp the magnitude of what his father had accomplished on Dune, and felt a growing respect for parted kinds. Wistful at times, Leet imagined what it would take to return Seleucia to the glory it had enjoyed long ago, as the focal point of the Imperium. There was so much left to understand here, so many questions still unanswered. With some well-placed weather installations, along with hardy colonists willing to replant prairies and forests, Seleucia Secundus might live and breathe again. But House Corino refused to invest in such an enterprise, no matter what rewards they might reap. In fact, it seemed that their effort was directed toward keeping Seleucia the same as it had been for all these centuries. Why would they do that? As a stranger on this world, Leet spent most of his free time with a pack and survival gear, wandering across the ravaged landscape, avoiding the ruins of long-destroyed cities where prisoners inhabited the ancient imperial government buildings, towering museums, immense halls, great chambers with collapsed ceilings. In all the centuries Seleucia had been a Corino prison world, no one had tried to rebuild. Walls were leaning or tumbled over. Roofs had huge holes. Leet had devoted his first weeks to studying the underground smuggler base. He instructed the hardened veterans in how to erase traces of their presence, how to alter the collapsed hangar so that it looked as if it were inhabited by only a few feral refugees, attracting nothing more than a cursory glance. When the smugglers were safely hidden, and Dominic satisfied, the young freeman went out exploring on his own, as his father had done. Moving with great care so as not to dislodge pebbles or crumbled dirt that might leave a mark of his presence, Leet climbed a ridge to look down upon a basin. Through binoculars he saw people moving under the crackling sunlight, soldiers in mottled tan and brown uniforms, desert camouflage used by the Emperor's Sardaukar troops, extravagant war games again. A week ago he'd watched the Sardaukar root out a nest of prisoners barricaded in an isolated ruin. Leet had been hiking nearby and saw the Imperials attack with all their might, wearing full body shields, using flamethrowers and primitive weapons against the convicts. The one-sided battle had gone on for hours, as well-trained Sardaukar fought hand-to-hand against hardened prisoners who boiled out of the stronghold. The Emperor's men had slaughtered many prisoners, but some had fought back extremely well, even taking down several Sardaukar, commandeering their weapons, and prolonging the fight. When only a few dozen of the best fighters remained holed up and ready to die, the Sardaukar planted a stun bomb. After the troops fell back behind barricades, a pulse beacon of intense light, coupled with the motivational force of a Holtzman field, knocked the surviving prisoners unconscious, allowing the Sardaukar to swarm inside. Leet had wondered why the Imperial soldiers didn't just plant a stunner in the first place. Later he wondered if the Sardaukar might have been culling the prisoners, selecting the best candidates. Now, days later, some of those surviving captives stood out on the scorched basin wearing tattered, mismatched clothes, the remnants of prison uniforms. Around them the Sardaukar formed regimented lines, a human grid. Weapons and pieces of heavy equipment were parked at strategic positions around the perimeter, tethered down with metal spikes and chains. The men seemed to be training, prisoners and Sardaukar alike. As he crouched on the top of the ridge, Leet felt vulnerable without his stillsuit. The dry taste of thirst scratched in his mouth, reminding him of the desert, of his home. But he had no catch tube at his neck for a sip of water. Earlier that day, they had distributed another load of melange smuggled from Dune, selling it to escaped prisoners who hated the Carinos as much as Dominic did. In the common room, Gurney Halleck had raised a cup of spice-laced coffee in a salute to his leader. He strummed an F-sharp chord on his balisette, added a minor chord, and then sang in his bold, gruff voice, which, though not melodious, was at least exuberant. Oh, cup of spice to carry me beyond my flesh to a distant star. Mélange, they call it. Mélange, mélange. The men cheered, and Bork Kazon, the Seleucid camp cook, poured him a fresh cup of spice coffee. The broad-shouldered Cyan Traff, formerly an Ixian engineer, patted Gurney on the back, and the one-time merchant Pen Barlow, ever-present cigar in his mouth, laughed boisterously. The song had made Leet want to walk on the spice sands himself, to savor the pungent cinnamon odor as it wafted up from a sandworm he rode. Perhaps Warwick would come to escort him back to Redwall Siege, once they returned from Seleucia. He hoped so. It had been too long since he'd seen his friend and blood brother. Warwick and Ferula had been married for nearly a year and a half. Perhaps, by now, she was even carrying his child. Leet's life would have been so different if only he had won her hand instead. Now, though, he crouched in the rocks of a high ridge on a different planet, spying on the mysterious movements of Imperial troops. Leet adjusted the binocular's high-definition oil lenses for the best possible view. As the Sardaukar drifted across the barren basin, he studied the speed and precision with which they moved. Still, Leet thought, a desperate group of well-armed freemen might be able to defeat them. Finally, the surviving prisoners were led out onto the training field in front of new Sardaukar barracks, alloy tentments clustered like bunkers on the open flat, metal sides reflecting hazy sunlight. The soldiers seemed to be testing the prisoners, challenging them to keep up with their exercises. When one man faltered, a Sardaukar killed him with a purple blast from a laser gun. The others didn't pause. Leet Kynes turned his gaze from the military drills to the bilious sky, which bore ominous patterns he'd been taught to recognize. The air looked soupy as it roiled a deep orange edged with streaks of green, as if from indigestion. Clumps of ball lightning drifted across the sky. Clusters of static, like huge snowflakes, channeled the flow of wind toward the basin. From stories told by Gurney Halleck and the other smugglers, Leet knew the dangers of being exposed in an aurora storm. But part of him, the curious part he'd inherited from his father, watched in awed fascination as the electrical and radioactive disturbance flowed closer. The tempest was accompanied by tendrils of exotic color, ionized air, and cone-shaped funnels known as the hammer wind. Uneasy at being so exposed, he found cracks in the outcropping behind him. The Talus Caves provided enough shelter for any resourceful freeman to wait out the harsh weather. But the troops below were unprotected. Did they have the gall to think they could survive against such raw elemental power? Seeing the clouds and discharges approach, the ragged prisoners began to break ranks, while the uniformed troops stood firm. The commander barked orders, apparently telling them to return to their places. Seconds later, a powerful gust of precursor wind nearly toppled the craggy-faced man from his wobbly, levitating platform. The tall leader shouted for everyone to fall back to their metal bunkers. The Sardaukar marched in lockstep, perfectly trained. Some of the prisoners tried to emulate the soldiers. while others just fled into the reinforced shelters. The Aurora storm struck only moments after the last of the tentments had been sealed. Like a living thing, it ripped across the basin, flashing multicolored lightning. A great fist of hammer wind pounded the ground. Another slammed into one of the tentments, flattening the metal-walled shelter and crushing everyone inside. Boiling, crackling air swept toward the ridge. Although this was not his planet, Leet had understood the potentially lethal nature of storms since childhood. He ducked down from his exposed vantage, slid along the rocks until he could worm his way between two tall boulders and deep into a crack of rock. Within moments, he heard the demonic howling, the crackle of air, the discharges of ball lightning, the pounding slams of hammer wind. In the narrow slice of visible sky between the rocks, Leet watched a kaleidoscope of colors that flashed with retina-searing glare. He huddled back, but sensed he was as safe as he could be. Breathing calmly, patiently waiting for the storm to blow over, he stared at the frenzied intensity of the Aurora storm. Seleucia exhibited many similarities with Dune. Both were harsh worlds, with unforgiving lands, unforgiving skies. On Dune, ferocious storms could also reshape the landscape, crushing a man into the ground or stripping flesh from his bones. Somehow, though, unlike this place, those terrible winds made sense to him, linked, as they were, to the mystery and grandeur of Dune. Leet wanted to leave Seleucia Secundus, to return to his home world with Dominic Vernius. He needed to live in the desert again, where he belonged. When the time was right, Dominic Vernius took part of his smuggling crew back in his frigate, accompanied by the two small lighters. Dominic piloted his own flagship, guiding the vessel into its assigned berth in the hold of the Guild Highliner. The renegade Earl went to his stateroom to relax and contemplate. Though he'd spent years operating in the shadows of the Imperium, a gadfly to annoy Shaddam IV, he had never struck a clear and decisive blow. Yes, he had stolen the shipment of the Emperor's commemorative coins, and he'd floated the hilarious balloon caricature over the Pyramid Stadium on Harmonthep. Yes, he had scrawled the snide 100-meter-tall message on the granite canyon wall. Shaddam, does your crown rest comfortably on your pointy head? And he had defaced dozens of statues and monuments as well. But to what end? Ix was still lost, and he had no new information on the situation there. Early in his self-imposed exile, Dominic had rallied his troops, men selected because of their loyalty in past campaigns. Remembering how they had defeated the Akazi rebels years before, he had led a small force, heavily armed and well-trained, in a raid against the new Tleilaxu stronghold. With weapons and the advantage of surprise, Dominic had hoped to blast his way in and overthrow the invaders. At the port of Entry Canyon, he and his men rushed from their ships, firing laser guns. But they had encountered astonishing defenses from the Emperor's own Sardaukar. The damned Carinos! Why were their troops still involved here? Years ago, the element of surprise had been turned against Dominic, and the crack Imperial soldiers killed fully a third of his men. He himself had been hit in the back by debris from a laser gun blast and left for dead. Only Jodam had dragged him back to one of their ships, in which they beat a desperate retreat. In Dominic's secret stronghold at the south pole of Arrakis, his men had nursed him back to health. Since he had taken precautions to conceal the identity of the avenging attack force, to avoid repercussions against the Ixian people should the assault fail, or against his children on Caladan, the Tleilaxu had never learned who had come after them. As a result of the debacle, Dominic had sworn to his men that he would never again try to recapture his hereditary world in a military action, which could only end poorly. Out of necessity, Dominic had decided to settle for other means. His sabotage and vandalism, however, had been largely ineffectual. No more than tiny blips on House Carino balance sheets or imperial embarrassments. Shaddam IV didn't even know that the outcast Earl Vernius was involved. Though he continued the struggle, Dominic felt worse than dead. He was irrelevant. He lay back in his cabin on the frigate, assessing everything he had achieved, and all that he'd lost. With a solido hollow portrait of Shando standing on a pedestal nearby, he could look at her and almost imagine she was still there, still with him. Their daughter Kylea must be an attractive young woman by now. He wondered if she was married, perhaps to someone in the court of Leto Atreides. Certainly not to the Duke himself. The Atreides' emphasis on political marriages was well known, and the princess of a renegade house had no dowry. Likewise, though Romber was old enough to become the Earl of House Vernius, the title was valueless. With immense sadness sagging his shoulders, he gazed at the hollow image of Shando on the pedestal. And in his grief, she spoke to him.
Dominic. Dominic Vernius. I know your identity.
Startled, he sat up, wondering if he had descended into a labyrinth of madness. Her mouth moved mechanically. The hollow of her face turned, but her expression did not change. Her eyes did not focus on him. The words continued.
I am using this image to communicate with you. I must present a message from Ix.
Dominic trembled as he approached the image.
Shando?
No.
I am the navigator of this highliner. I have chosen to speak through this hollow image because it is difficult to communicate otherwise.
Reluctant to believe this, Dominic fought back superstitious fear. Just seeing the likeness of Shando move, seeing her face come alive again, infused him with a trembling awe he had not experienced in a long time.
Yes, whoever you are. What is it you want of me?
My brother, Keter Pilru, sends these words from Ix. He begs me to give you this information. I can do no more than instruct you.
Her lips moving faster, and using a different voice this time, Shando's hollow image repeated the words Keter had sent in a desperate message to his navigator brother. In growing horror, Dominic listened, and learned the extent of damage the Tleilaxu usurpers had inflicted on his beloved world and its people. Rage simmered within him. When he had begged for assistance during the first Tleilaxu attacks, damnable old Emperor Elrud IX had stalled, thereby guaranteeing the defeat of House Vernius. Bitter at their loss, Dominic only wished the old man hadn't died before he could find a way to kill him. But now Dominic realized the imperial plan was much broader, much more insidious. At its core, the entire Tleilaxu takeover had been an imperial plot, with Sardaukar troops still enforcing it nearly 20 years later. Elrud had set up the conflict from the start, and his son Shaddam perpetuated the scheme by oppressing the remaining subjects of House Vernius. Presently, the voice from the Shando likeness changed again, returning to the more ponderous and disconnected words of the navigator.
On my route in this vessel, I can take you to Shuta, formerly known as Ix.
Do it, Dominic said, with hatred icing his heart. I wish to see the horrors for myself, and then I...
He put a hand to his breast, as if swearing a vow to Shando.
I, Lord Dominic, Earl of House Vernius, will avenge the suffering of my people.
When the Highliner went into orbit, Dominic met with Asuyo, Jodam, and the others. Return to Arrakis. Go to our base and continue our work. I'm taking one of the lighters.
He stared at the pedestal as if he could still see his wife there. I have business of my own. The two veterans expressed their surprise and confusion, but Dominic pounded his fist on the table. No further argument. I have made my decision. He glared at his men, and they were amazed to see such a transformation in his personality. But where are you going? Leet asked. What do you plan to do? I am going to Ix. One uses power by grasping it lightly. To grasp with too much force is to be taken over by power, thus becoming its victim. Bene Gesserit Axiom. The Baron did not take the news about his half-brother at all well. At the Harco City spaceport, men were loading his private frigate with the amenities, supplies, and personnel he would need for a trip to Arrakis. In order to keep spice operations running smoothly, he had to spend months at a time on the desert hellhole, squeezing his fist to prevent smugglers and the accursed freemen from getting out of hand. But after the damage Abelard had done years ago, the Baron had turned the most economically important planet in the Imperium back into a huge moneymaker. House profits were increasing steadily. And now, just when everything seemed to be going his way, he had to deal with this. Abelard, for all his stupidity, had an incredible knack for doing precisely the wrong thing every time. Peter de Vries, sensing his superior's displeasure, approached with mincing steps, wanting to assist, or to appear to be doing so. But he knew better than to come too close. For years he had survived by avoiding the Baron's wrath, longer than any of his master's previous mentats. In his younger, leaner days, Vladimir Harkonnen had been capable of lashing out like a cobra and striking a person in the larynx to cut off his breathing. But now he had grown so soft, so corpulent, that de Vries could easily slither out of the way. Simmering, the Baron sat in the keep's stone-walled accounting room. His oval black plaz table looked polished enough to ice skate on. A huge globe of Arrakis stood in one corner, an art object any noble family would have coveted. But rather than show it off at Landsrad gatherings or blue blood social events, the Baron kept it in his private room, savoring the globe for himself. Peter, what am I to do? He gestured toward a cluster of message cylinders newly arrived via bonded courier. The Chome Corporation demands an explanation, warning me in none too subtle terms that they expect shipments of whale fur to continue from Lankaville despite the change in rulership. He snorted. As if I would decrease our quotas. They remind me that spice production on Arrakis is not the only vital commodity House Harkonnen controls. They've threatened to revoke my Chome directorship if I fail to meet my obligations. With a flick of his wrist, he hurled a copper-sheathed message cylinder at the wall. It clanged and clattered, leaving a white nick on the stone. He picked up a second cylinder. Emperor Shaddam wants to know why my own half-brother would renounce the Harkonnen name and take the sub-district governorship for himself. Again he hurled the cylinder at the wall. It struck with a louder clink beside the first white mark. He picked up a third. House Moritani on Grumman offers covert military support in case I wish to take direct action. The third cylinder struck the wall. House Richese, House Mutelli, all curious, all laughing behind my back. He continued to throw message cylinders until his table was clear. One of the metal tubes rolled toward Peter, and he picked it up. You didn't open this one, my lord. Well, do it for me. It probably says the same as all the others. Of course. The Mentat used one of his long fingernails to cut the seal on the capsule, and slid the cap off. Bringing out a piece of Instroy paper, he scanned it, his tongue darting over his lips. Ah, from our operative on Caladan. The Baron perked up. Good news, I hope. DeVries smiled as he translated the cipher. Kiara apologizes for her inability to get messages out before this, but she is making progress with the concubine, Kylie Vernius, turning her against the Duke.
Well, that's something, anyway.
The Baron rubbed his fat chin.
I would have preferred word of Leto's assassination. Now that would have been really good news.
Kiara likes to do things in her own way, at her own pace. The Inthtroi message faded, and DeVries balled it up, then tossed it and the cylinder aside. We aren't sure how far she'll go, my lord, for she has certain standards in royal matters. Spying is one thing, murder is quite another, and she's the only one we could get past Thufir Hawat's security.
All right, all right.
The two of them had been over this before. The Baron pushed himself up from his seat.
At least we're throwing a bit of sand in the Duke's eye.
Perhaps we should do more than that to Abelard. Aided by the suspensor system at his waist, the fat man misjudged the strength of his own flabby arms and nearly flew off his feet. Wisely, DeVries said nothing about that, and absorbed data so that he could perform a proper mentat analysis as soon as his master demanded it.
Perhaps.
The Baron's face reddened.
Abelard's older brother Maritin was an idiot, you know. Literally, I mean. A drooling, brain-damaged moron who couldn't even dress himself, though his mother simpered over him, as if Maritin was worth the resources expended to keep him alive.
His jowly face was blotched with pent-up rage.
Now it seems that Abelard is just as brain-damaged, but in a more subtle way.
He slammed his flat palm down on the oily black plaz surface, leaving a handprint that would gradually be broken down by self-cleaning systems in the furniture.
I didn't even know his bitch Emmy was pregnant. Now he's got another son, a sweet little baby, and Abelard's robbed the child of his birthright.
The Baron shook his head.
You realize that boy could be a leader, another Harkonnen heir, and his foolish father takes it all away.
With his master's frustration building, DeVries took extra care to stay out of reach, on the opposite side of the oval table. My lord, as near as I can tell, Abelard has followed the precise forms of law. According to Landsrad rules, he is allowed to request and receive a concession that few of us would even have considered. We may not think it wise, but Abelard was within his rights as part of House Harkonnen.
I am House Harkonnen! The Baron roared. He doesn't have any rights unless I say so.
He came around the desk. The Mentat stood frozen, afraid the corpulent man might attack him after all. Instead, he bobbed toward the door of the chamber.
We go to see Rabban.
They walked through the echoing halls of the blocky keep to an external armored lift that dropped them from the keep's spiked pinnacles down to an enclosed arena. Glossu Rabban worked with the house guard to prepare for the evening scheduled gladiatorial combat, a tradition the Baron had established as a precursor to each of his long journeys to Arrakis. Inside the arena, silent slaves cleaned the tiers of seats, polishing and sweeping away debris. The Baron's great contests always drew large crowds, and he used such spectacles to impress guests of other great houses. Heavy durasteel doors at the gladiator pit level remained closed, trapping caged beasts for combat. Hirsute, shirtless workers hosed down the empty pens of slain creatures or slaves, then dusted them with odor suppressants. Sweating, though he didn't appear to be doing any work, Rabban stood in the midst of the men. Wearing a sleeveless jerkin of studded leather, he rested his hands at his waist, pursed thick lips, and glowered at the activity. Other laborers raked the sand of the arena floor, sifting out bone fragments and shattered blades. Kriubi, captain of the house guard, directed his soldiers.
He decided where to station each armed man to provide an appropriately impressive military presence for the upcoming festivities. Buoyed by his suspensor belt, the Baron glided down the waterfall of steps, passing through a spiked iron gate, and emerged on the stained arena floor. His feet barely touched the ground, giving his walk a ballet-like grace. Peter DeVries followed him with similar dancing steps. Kriubi stepped up and saluted. "My Baron," he said, "everything is prepared. We shall have a spectacular event tonight."
"As always," DeVries said, a smile twisting his sappho-stained lips.
"How many beasts do we have?" the Baron asked. 2 Lhasa tigers, my lord, 1 Deca bear, and 1 Seleucid bull."
With glittering black eyes, the Baron studied the arena and nodded.
"I'm weary this evening. I don't want a long combat. Release the beasts and all 5 chosen slaves at once. We'll have a free-for-all."
Kriubi gave a brisk salute.
"As you wish, my lord."
The Baron turned to his Mentat.
"The blood will fly tonight, Peter. Maybe it will distract me from what I'd like to do to Abelard."
"Do you prefer to be merely distracted, my Baron?" the Mentat asked. "Or do you prefer satisfaction? Why not have your revenge on Abelard?" A moment of hesitation, then,
"Revenge will do quite nicely, Peter. Raban!"
His nephew turned to see the Baron and his Mentat standing there. On stocky legs, Raban marched across the arena floor to the 2 men.
"Did Peter tell you what your fool father has done now?"
Raban's expression contorted.
"Yes, uncle. Sometimes I can't understand how such a clod can get through the day."
"It's true that we don't understand Abelard," DeVries said. "But one of the important laws of statecraft suggests that to utterly defeat one's enemy, one must understand him, learn his weaknesses, learn where it will hurt the most."
"Abelard's entire brain is his weakness," the Baron mumbled, his tone dark. "Or maybe just his bleeding heart."
Raban chuckled, too loudly. The Mentat held up 1 long finger. "Consider this. His infant son, Fade Rautha Raban, is now his greatest vulnerability. Abelard has taken an extraordinary step in order to, as he puts it, see that the child is raised in a proper fashion. Apparently this means a great deal to him." The Baron looked at his broad-shouldered nephew.
"We wouldn't want Raban's little brother turning out like Abelard, would we?"
Raban glowered at the possibility. DeVries continued, his voice as smooth as oiled ice. "And so what is the most terrible thing we could do to Abelard under these circumstances? What would cause him the greatest pain and despair?" A cold smile crossed the Baron's face.
"Brilliant question, Peter. And for that you shall live another day.